Hello and welcome to Dynamite Neddy. We've got a very special batch of episodes coming out. We're going to be recording remotely due to the global pandemic we're currently in the middle of. I hope everybody else is currently staying in their gaffs. So if you notice that the recording quality is maybe a wee bit iffy, it's because I'm in my house like a good boy. Mr. Mick McCormick.
Yep, I'm at my house as well. I'm sitting where I've been working at home, so if you hear me saying anything about like KPIs or like action and targets and stuff like that, then I'd apologise.
He's getting his wires crossed. And also staying at home like a good boy, we have Mr. Andy MacArthur.
Reach you off for the bunker. We're doing, man.
So again, we're not going to inundate you with advice. We're not going to talk about the scary virus because you're on here to escape from that if you're listening to us fucking idiots. Stay in your gaffs. That's all you're getting for me. Boys, if you've got anything to add.
I think we've missed an opportunity to save a life for cheers.
I got some bad taste. I want that place fucking burnt to the ground.
Fair enough, man.
Aye. Oh. Putting Greenock, our home town, on the map for the rest of Scotland has been fucking... like Scotland shame.
Aye, pretty much.
Yes, if anybody's not realising, this is a famously fucking hard pub in Greenock that decided to flout the rules of the pubs closing, subsequently get raided by the police, and there's a whole big rammy about it, and the whole country's united in condemning them.
You ever seen the Still Game episode with Blighty's hard as boozers?
The
guy comes to like record a documentary. Well, it was like that because the guy for the sun came in with a camera.
I was encouraging them all to pose, wasn't he?
But the people there thought that it was great. They were going to be heroes over Scotland because we're still drinking that, and it's just so fucking misguided, man.
Aye. If you've got nothing to add on that front.
Oh, no, please no.
Right, well, what he's been up to then, what he's been playing?
Pretty much fucking sitting, just going through all my old consoles, man. I hooked them all up, I've got them all. I've got an HDMI splitter, no, what do you call that? A SCART splitter. So I could have more than one plugged in at once.
Ah, cool.
So I kind of flip between each one at my leisure, man. And
That's what you want.
Aye, and I've been trying to find a game that I can really get into over the next few months, because it's going to be a long time to sit in. So I need something that's going to really suck us in, man, and like fucking keep us there. Because, I mean, I can do wee short bursts of my arcade games like the one I will talk about today, but I need like a big juicy RPG or something.
Join Mick and playing Final Fantasy VI.
I've been replaying it, man. It's been class. Still holds up just as well.
Well, you know what? I did say, man, that I was looking at it the other day, and... I just heard the theme tune kind of starting in my head. And I was like, I need to play this again. So it's a good shout.
Well, sure, I sent you a voice note the other day when I was playing it, and it would have had the music in the background. But I like Shadow. Shadow's my kind of guy. You know, he's a fucking mad ninja mercenary. It just floats about everywhere with this fucking cracking dog. But I'd paid him to join my party, as during the early bits of the game, you have to give him money or he doesn't join you. And then I equipped him with hunters of good stuff, and he fucked off at the end of the fight and took my fucking best relic.
Andy was talking about that in Fantasy Star the other week as well. It's a fucking common issue in RPGs.
Oh, in Fantasy Star 4, you could equip somebody with all your best gear and then they fuck off and they're not in the story anymore.
that's one thing I hate about JRPGs, man. But you fucking level up this item, boom, 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 and you get a guy that disappears in the next cutscene and dies.
I downloaded Celeste. You heard of that one? Kind of indie platformer.
Aye, a lot of people love that.
It's pretty good. It's fucking really hard. I didn't realise how hard it was meant to be. It's fucking solid as it is. It's like kind of Super Meat Boy-esque difficulty.
Aye, it's all pinpoint kind of platforming in it. It's all about learning how to control her really well.
Aye, but like, it's kind of like Super Meat Boy, but yeah, I guess a bit of a story, and then like, you know, that some of the levels have their own mechanics and that in it and stuff, so it seems pretty cool, but I'm only giving it a short try. And they released an expansion to it where if there's a kind of blink and you miss it reference to the protagonist being trans, and then I lost their minds.
It's a sticker on a PC, isn't it? A trans flag?
Aye, it's a wee flag.
Aye. I mean, who the fuck cares, man? It's a nice thing to do.
Aye.
Are they all into games, Seema? I need to get into it. I need to get into it, man, at some point.
There's been plenty. Andy, you like your platformers, man. There's been a lot of good kind of indie ones in recent years, if you go on Steam. And they usually don't need a good PC. Most of them are just 2D pixel art type things.
Aye. There's a lot of cheap kind of games as well, aren't there, out there on Steam? I'm probably missing.
Well, I think with a lot of the indie games is a lot of the best ones end up on your consoles anyway. You'll be able to play Super Meat Boy in that on your Xbox.
Aye.
What's that one? What's that one? Aero likes? It was kind of like a Sonic game, but no.
Freedom Planet, maybe? Freedom Planet's good.
That game is actually made with fucking Stealth and Taxman's Sonic Mania engine.
Oh, all right, cool.
Ah.
That's actually a product of the Sonic Fan Games headquarters.
Shovel Knight's really good as well. It's like you're playing this fucking cracking undiscovered 16-bit game. It's beautiful, except it looks and sounds a bit better, obviously, because they can do things that your consoles couldn't.
I think that's the one I mean, Shovel Knight. I think that's the one I was mentioning.
Are you okay?
Sonic, man, it does it well though. There's a lot of what was the one I gave Mick with the frog in it? Yeah, the frog.
Super frog.
Aye. That's an example of fucking them not maybe doing it so well, but nowadays you can see they've kind of got the formula together.
I'm always dreading words like super frog coming out of your mouth when you're getting us games.
Oh, fuck up, man.
See, I'm always kind of like, I'm sometimes dreading getting a game for Andy unless if it's a pure shiter, but some of those can be the funniest ones to talk about sometimes.
Aye, that's true.
For a wee sneak preview, because our last episode was a... There's one we're meant to record which hasn't been put out yet, but we kind of preloaded another game to play before that, and Andy's asked me to play Quest 64, which that's a kind of notorious game, but it's been an interesting experience.
I want to say shite, but it's got its charms. Like, everybody's just called pure generic names, aren't they? Like Nigel, Brian, and...
Your main character's called Brian.
Everybody kind of hates it. I'm wondering if it's a wee bit misunderstood. It seems as if it's no all bad from what Mick's been saying.
I'll go into it.
I think his problem is it's just so generic. But you really get any more generic than calling an RPG for the N64 Quest 64.
That's like a placeholder name that they just didn't get rid of.
I've heard that there's things to like about it, like the battle system, the way the kind of buttons are mapped to kind of different things, your different elemental spells are mapped to different buttons. Like there's good points here, but if they'd just done this and that, then it would have been really good.
Aye, there's a few things I like about it. I won't talk about it too much if I put it in a proper episode, but it's definitely interesting. I've also been playing Lemmings 2. Lemmings 2 is fucking solid. I did not remember this. It starts off a lot harder than the original.
Aye, man. Lemmings 1 has got some of the best artwork in the world, but I've not played Lemmings 2.
Well, we were talking about this the other day. I was talking to McCormick last night. Lemmings kind of starts off with gradual difficulty. You get a training level that kind of shows you what each individual lemon does, whereas 2 kind of presupposes you know more about lemons.
Some lemons like dispensable. You're allowed to lose a certain amount of lemons, aren't you? You're the unlucky lemon that's got to jump off a building.
You'll usually get a percentage of them that you need to save. That you need to use as a blocker, they usually end up just getting exploded.
Like collateral damage.
In 2, you've got 12 tribes, which I don't know if it's a biblical reference, but... all tribes of lemmings, and each series of levels you've got to take that tribe on a journey. But you'll start the first level with 100, and then if you lose 2 in that level, you'll start the next one with 98. So it gets harder as it goes on.
That's actually quite a good mechanic, man, because in the last one it was just like you get the same amount every level, but this one it kind of, you've got to hold on to your lemons through the game type of thing.
Aye, so you can replay previous levels to try and get to try and get better at them. But it introduces like so many new types of them. We kind of have different powers, and some of the powers can be quite tricky to work with, because it's like, because they're so small, like trying to figure out the right time to deploy them and stuff like that, that can be quite tough.
I don't ever played one. I mean, you were talking about two last night, saying that there's fucking jetpack lemons and stuff like that. I was like, what the fuck, man? Let's do
it. Jetpacks, there's Icarus wings, there's a pole vaulter, there's one with a laser beam.
At a certain point, it turns into two jar Monero.
I don't know, I got a bit of worms kind of, I don't know if it's just because of the different options at the bottom, man, but I don't know, man.
They look quite
worms and lemmings kind of occupy a similar place in my mind. I think it's because they're about animals and they've got tiny sprites in them
and they're laid out kind of, I see.
Well, I think lemmings are Scottish, obviously. I think worms might be English.
Yeah.
Did we not have a scary experience with worms for the Mega Drive? No.
Something
the music playing on its own or something, I don't know. I just got a good memory of it back in the day. On a Mega Drive, we walked, we rented it out, and I think we heard the music playing for the computer room, and Worms wasn't even on a console or something. No?
Worms creepypasta. The haunted cartridge.
Aye, somebody get on a 4chan and write that.
The previous person that rented it committed suicide.
Aye. Aye, we're doing a stern, stab myself in the eye with a fork.
I get hit with a fucking super sheep or whatever you call them, holy hand grenade.
Yeah, worms are so racist, man.
Oh, were they kamikaze?
Aye, man, you see that for me. They put three fucking Japanese bandana on and then puts his ones together, right? Come on. That's a bit fucking, yeah, girlish, isn't it?
I thought you were going to talk about the Scottish accent.
Is Worms fucking Scottish? No.
No, it's British for sure. Lemons is Scottish.
It will.
Yeah. Lemons, DMA design. Roof,
English bastards copying a Scottish voice.
Right, now that we've got the requisite anglophobia out the way, I'm going to talk about what the episode today is going to be about. This one's a wee bit kind of hastily constructed. We decided yesterday that we were going to start doing these once a week, so we thought it would be a good idea if we recorded today, based on a suggestion for the wonderful Mr. Andy Mack. We've all just picked an old favourite. We're just going to talk about an old favourite that we think might be quite interesting to talk about and that we played last night, effectively.
Pretty much. And I thought, I don't know, man, what you were thinking, but I was thinking, like, I'm getting fucking really into my Saturn now and I had to do something on short notice. So I picked a very, very short game just to kind of make it work, man. But it's a very classic game today, so hopefully we can have a bit of fun talking about it.
Andy, why don't you first of all talk to us about why you picked Virtua Fighter 2?
No bother. Right, Virtua Fighter 2 for the Saturn. Originally an arcade game, one of the most popular arcade games that ever came out in Japan. To this day, it's still the highest grossing arcade game in Japan ever. Ported to Saturn in 1995 by Sega AM2. I chose it because I remember back in the day, sitting down, I was only a Mortal Kombat man at the time, a wee bit of Street Fighter in Connolly's, a pub which was round the corner from me. But apart from that, I was Mortal Kombat all the way. And then,
Street Fighter's the kind of technically superior game, but Mortal Kombat had the fucking blood and the guts and the pizzazz that Elaine couldn't resist.
Aye, Mortal Kombat was the fucking, was the one back in the day, man. But then a wee guy that I knew, who I'll remain nameless, got a Saturn somehow. And we went up and played it, and he had two games. He had, what was the first one he had? It was Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, which was fucking class, man. But then he said, ah, you think this is good, do you? Watch this. And he put on Virtua Fighter 2, and I just sat in my fucking John F. Lair, man. I can remember this clear as day. 3D polygonal fucking fighting, smashing each other's cunt in. You get that crunch you get like in the Sonic games when you punch. You actually need to think about like, what you're doing before you do it and stuff like that. You don't kind of just button mash. It's a very technical fighter. And it's also a backstory too.
What a lot of people forget, when you look at particularly Virtua Fighter 1, because the first time I seen Virtua Fighter was in an arcade, and there was no such thing as a 3D fighter at that point. People think it looks blocky and ridiculous now, but fucking hell, man. My jaw hit the floor when I first saw the first one, you know?
Aye, well, the first one is... Aye, the first one came out as a sort of... I see it as a sort of kind of test thing for what it could be.
For a tech demo?
Aye, because the arcade board that was at the time, it was quite a limited thing, man. It was based on... It wasn't based on certain hardware at all. It was the same kind of thing. What was it called again? I know the one after it was a Naomi, but this was called something else. I think it was a Model 2.
Uh-huh.
It was called... Was it Model 2 arcade hardware or something it was called? It was basically, before this, you just had your 2D kind of games, like Ghouls and Ghosts and that. But this was a big step up to, like, polygonal hardware acceleration. The ability to run at 60 frames per second, high resolution, NES loading and all that. And texture mapping and motion capture and all the rest of it. So it was quite a step forward. If you think about it, man, if you've been playing Mortal Kombat for a few years and then you sit and you're playing this, you know, it's some jump, man. Some jump.
Aye.
Did you say the original one doesn't look great now, but I mean, there wasn't any hardware that could push that many polygons at the time. So, like, you know, it did blow people's minds.
There wasn't. And when this first one got released, you know, a lot of people kind of thought, where the fuck could this go? And they answered the question with Virtua Fighter 2, which I think is the first proper Virtua Fighter game. If we're looking at moveset, if we're looking at character selection, if we're looking at, like, quality of graphics and gameplay, I think Virtua Fighter 2 was the first one that was an actual, like, completed game.
See, this is a series that's passed me by a wee bit. So something I was wondering off the bat is, are they still making Virtua Fighter games?
Well, they've made up to Virtua Fighter 5, but I think it's been a few years. Sega are kind of in a weird transition period at the moment. They became a publisher rather than a developer for a while, and they're sort of looking back to their roots a wee bit and making games again, and they even dipped their feet into, like, the Football Manager market and that. They'd publish that and all that shit, so...
Aye.
I don't know if we're going to get any more franchise games. We get plenty of Sonic games, but beyond that, I'm not too sure if they're keeping up their franchises. But Virtua Fighter, I've played a lot of fighting games. It's something I really like. And Virtua Fighter, man, that's the most technical one. You've really got to think about what you're doing when you're fighting.
So tell us a bit about why you like this in particular. Because, I mean, when I think of fighting games, it's a bit like Sophie's Choice, you know what? I love the Soul Calibur series. I love playing Soul Blade. Tekken's amazing. Mortal Kombat's amazing. Why come to this one?
Right. Well, this game is different in that it's very reality based. Like, you'll find that most fighting games have got, like, fucking plasma and, like, blood, like, and
fireballs
never take place in real life. In this game, each character's got their own fighting style that's loosely based on real world fighting methods. Like wrestling, like Eastern style, like kind of martial arts and that stuff. The characters have got shitloads of moves each. I counted Cage's moves last night. His moveset was up to, like, 42 moves, and that's just for one.
Is Cage your guy?
Cage is my guy because he's a ninja and he wears a blue suit and he can do. I think he's getting most moves in the game, and he's the hardest to master. And when he gets punished, his mask falls off, so you can see his face and that. He's good, man. He's good. Plus, he fights in the middle of the forest and away from everything.
So you've got previous for playing as pain in the arse characters like Keelik and Eddie.
Aye, but there isn't the one of them in this game. Lion is the one in this game for that. He's the kind of guy that he fights on the deck nearly, man. His knees are nearly touching the floor, and he's got his fingers like a fucking... like that fucking heavy metal sign, and he fights like that, and he punches like that. It's kind of weird, man.
Is that like a tiger style kung fu or something?
I think so, aye. Lion Rafale, I think his name is. It's called Mantis style.
Ah.
In addition to that, you've got, well, do you know what? You said Cage is my man. I think Shun-Di is possibly my man. He's a drunken kung fu master. And
I like a drunken master style. I like playing as an old man who looks like he can't really fight, but then he can fucking smash down.
Shun-Di, who is voiced incidentally by Charles Martinet, who is the voice of Super Mario.
Yahoo!
He fights with a bottle, like a wee kind of jug thing, like a mug or something, tied to his belt. And when he knocks him,
I think it's like a sake bottle or something.
It's like a gourd type thing.
Aye, and he takes a swig at man when he knocks a guy down. You've got that going on, man. And then you've got like Akira, who is your Ryu man or your fucking Louis Kang.
There's always one.
It's equivalent. And he's the guy, he's meant to be like the main man. I suppose if there was only a one player mode with one character, he'd be a man you played. And he's actually the inspiration for, you know, the old fucking favourite of mine, Ryu Hazuki. So
aye.
I like to think when I'm playing this game, like I'm playing after Shenmue 2 and like he's beat Landina and his whole life's evaporated and he's had to join the fucking Virtua Fighter tournament.
Well, Andy,
how's his jacket?
Andy, right, since I think you touched on this in the Shenmue episode and all, I believe that the Shenmue was originally being developed as a tie-in game, is that right? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, as I said, Virtua Fighter doesn't have a plot. It's got no narrative, man. There's no story, there's no intro. There's just
probably in the manual
a wee bit of text for every character. Jeffrey's like a reggae man. His hobby is like reggae and stuff. Drunken Master, I think his hobby is like literally drinking. Like shit, man. But there is.
I'm just imagining Super Mario with like chronic alcoholism.
The game is given a wee bit of a story in the Japanese manual, like writing like the bills of the Sega Saturn version, man.
Well, I mean, it's like a lot of these things, like Street Fighter 2 was supposed to be people with different fighting styles. It's just they're converging to fighting a world tournament, innit?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think you can get many more generic than this. Virtua Fighter 2 hinges around a fighting tournament where the greatest fighters in the world seek to compete for fame and glory. However, the tournament is organised by the sinister J6 Syndicate, who intend to use the information gathered to perfect their fighting cyborg, Jural.
I think that's a plot of Tekken as well.
But Jural obviously being the final boss, who, by the way, quite interesting fight, because once you've beaten the 10 rounds of normal characters, you then fight a bonus stage, which is against, as I said, the fighting cyborg, Jural, and it takes place underwater, so you move slower, and there's a kind of effect to the way you move. It lets you be able to execute your moves a lot more effectively. So it makes it a more technical fight because you put the time it better.
Does this join the long and illustrious list of shite water levels, or is it actually quite a good water level?
No, this water level's been engineered for this boss fight so that, right, okay, you're beating the 10 guys now, beat this cunt, but we're going to slow you down so you can't spam your combos. You need to beat them with pure.
Oh, that's interesting.
I quite like that.
Aye. So you need to use all your moves, man. And like he's one of them characters. Sorry, I'm saying he. Jural's a lassie. She's got all the moves for everybody else in the game. Her move list is like fucking 200 moves or something. So you can't.
She's like a clone character, like Mokajin or something like that.
Aye, I always like to think that the Phoenix Mirrors for Shenmue were used by Lan D to turn Nozomi into Jural. I don't know, man.
That was part of the fun of video games when you were a wee guy. You filled in the blanks and made up your own kind of headcanon, didn't you?
Aye, man. But it's quite a short game. I mean, most of the hard work is against Jural because it's a difficult boss fight on hard mode. But, you know, you've always got your ringouts that can help you. That's another thing that made Virtua Fighter stand out. I can't even think of another fighting game that had ringouts. Ringouts.
Soul Calibur. Soul Blade.
Soul Calibur, that's right. So it did. But ringouts can be your best mate or your worst enemy because there's a really funny mechanic in Virtua Fighter 2 that you can do. You can make the play area like fucking a foot long. So it's just a bit like Bushido Blade, his first hit, ring out.
Oh, right. You'd have loved Bushido Blade.
I've watched loads of videos about it. I've meant to be getting it off you, but obviously the fucking pandemic and shit. But we'll probably get it after in a couple of weeks or something.
Tensest fighting game you'll ever play. When we do get round to it, what I recommend is we make sure we've got two controllers, we play a couple of fucking heed-to-heeds against each other because it's tense as fuck. You'll love it.
Quality, man. But I want to talk a wee bit about the development for this game, because, I mean, the arcade version was tailor-made for the Model 2 board. However, porting the game to Saturn took about 12 months, because Saturn was... The Sega Saturn was notorious, man, for being difficult to develop for. I could get technical, but I'm not going to bother. All I'm going to say is the developers designed 4 new characters, and only 2 made it into a game. That was for the Saturn port. So they basically spent 12 months just trying to get a game onto the system, and they made 2 extra characters. Basically, Eugene Acker, who was the head of Sega AM2 at the time, wanted to do a soccer or rugby game. They called it soccer, right? It's football. But he, for some reason, the Japanese call it soccer, which is fine, I suppose. But the sports games had too many characters to animate, and they didn't have the computing power on the Saturn to make it work. So they decided that after working on Virtua Racing, which only had 1 car on the road, they wanted to make something with, at the very least, 2 characters on screen, and it left them with boxing and martial arts. And they animated the characters in Virtua Fighter 2. Sega actually turned to the American military for motion capture technology, which wasn't known yet in the game industry.
Did they gain them it?
well, the collapse of the Soviet Union, America's military simulation industry was placed in the private sector, so the timing was perfect.
Were they trying to make a fighting robot called Jarl as well? That, sounds like the sort of thing the fucking Black Works Department of the US military would be up to.
Direct quote for Eugene Acker: our budget for procuring the chip was only around 5,000 yen. and the chip they had in the jet fighter simulator was worth several billion. So settling on a price proved to be. I'm saying Eugene Acker, it was Yu Suzuki, man. How can I get that wrong?
Yu Suzuki's your boy.
Aye, Naka and Suzuki, man. Some team. But Ant and Dick.
I read a thing as well that the arcade team in Japan that made all the arcade games were kind of a law unto themselves, and they didn't really want anything to do with the Saturn team. Like, there was like some press conference and they were talking about all the games they were going to announce when the Saturn came out, and it was like, it's going to be brilliant. You're going to have the Golden Axe sequel, was it Revenge of Death Adder? And then they went to the arcade team and it was like, oh, can you give us a hand making a port of Revenge of Death Adder for the Saturn? And like, no. Oh. It's like, you can do it yourself. So that never ended up coming out.
Basically, Saturn had a 3D chip. Well, it wasn't a 3D chip. It's a separate CPU processor that was thrown at the last minute so it could be a 3D machine to compete with a PlayStation. It was built with 2D in mind. It was meant to be the ultimate 2D machine to follow the Sega Mega Drive. But because PlayStation was released a year earlier and had full arcade graphics and all that, then they fucking shot themselves and threw in a second CPU, which made it nearly impossible to program for. So a lot of the Saturn ports just used the 1 CPU, and you can see like discrepancies in like the draw distances in games like Wipeout and that compared to PS1 game versions. So it's not a very intuitive kind of console to program for, is what I'm trying to say.
Is it still very hard to emulate as well, is Saturn?
A lot of Saturn's development, people with dev kits these days are still struggling how to figure out what the fuck you do. To get all the pieces working and sync with each other. Mix a software program, you probably tell you better, man. McCormick.
Well, generally, like, the further away a machine's architecture is for a PC, then the more difficult it's going to be to run emulated on a PC. Like, if that, for example, has got 2 CPUs, that's not something you generally get in a computer. In the modern day, you've got multi-core, which is effectively like multiple CPUs running in parallel. So there might be a way to do it with like a multi-core processor, but that's only been a thing in recent years. That technology kind of probably wouldn't have been in PCs for a good while. So yeah, I'm not sure how the Saturn is to emulate these days. It might be better, but it's just because it works in a bit of a different way to a PC would.
Aye. So anyway, Suzuki was looking for this fucking chip, as I was saying, and he had 5,000 yen, which I think is about £500, isn't it? What's 5,000 yen?
It's not even that much. let's find out what it is in today's money. It's about 40 quid.
40 quid. That's the next bit of his quote. They said they could offer a cheaper mass-produced chip that was only 200 million yen. So all we had to do was make up the difference. Laughs and brag. 200 million yen. In the end, Sega stumped up the 200 million yen and the game was a hit, and the video game industry gained mass-produced texture mapping as a result. So maybe Suzuki and Naka are less like Ant and Deck and more like Tom York and Johnny Greenwood. And being innovative, you know.
So see, getting away from the technical aspect, Andy, talk us through your gameplay experience. Did you complete this last night? How did you get on? Was it as good as you remember it being?
Aye. So I play this game all the time, man. Like, at least once a month. Because it takes me about 10 minutes. Once you get a move list in your head, I think you're a wee bit the same with Street Fighter 2. You've got a lot of moves like, memorised, didn't you? It's like muscle memory.
The
combos.
You learn how to play a character.
Aye, so sometimes you're not even thinking, man, when you're doing it. And I could finish Virtua Fighter 2 in 15, 20 minutes. So last night I finished it with Cage. Fucking bossed it, man. Absolutely bossed it. And then I done it with Shun. And Dural gave me a wee bit of a hassle with Shun. Because Shun isn't very good at forward momentum. Shun's better at, like, kind of... Remember Shenmue, when you had to fight, you had to like respect the other opponent's kind of fighting style so that you could avoid their attacks.
And so you had to anticipate it.
Aye, so you knew what way to, because there was an extra play in this game compared to a lot of fighting games, you could use it effectively, you could kind of sidestep their punches and that. So you had to kind of work them out, and sometimes it would take you 3 or 4 times that are getting beat before you actually worked out. So I had that experience last night with Shun. But do you know what, man? See, the game runs at 60 frames per second, right? It still looks brilliant. It's got that fucking, just that look I love, man. Early, like, Sega 3D kind of arcade games. Like, Daytona USA has got the same kind of thing. Virtua Cop, not that. You know,
kind of... Distinctive, aren't they? There's something about them.
Aye, they're cool. And let's not forget the soundtrack, man. The soundtrack is fucking class. It features a kind of 1 AM. Do you remember when they... Like Power Rangers would fight at the end, and you got that kind of Japanese rock kind.
A lot of the pure kind of naff power metal, wouldn't it?
Aye, I think Dragon Ball Z's got a bit of it too, man. But that's a lot of shit, man. And there's like a kind of Japanese kind of, there's always Japanese melodies going to all that shit. But it's actually pretty fucking good, man. You can pure tell it's made on like the 1994 equivalent of GarageBand, right? You can tell, but it's done well, man. That's one thing Sega had always done at that time, was create fucking amazing soundtracks, man, for any game. Doesn't matter what it was. It could be a shite game.
Do you have a standout track?
Yes, I do.
As if I don't know.
Right, okay, so my favourite tune, which I'm sure McCormick is going to shoehorn into here, using his is Level 2.
It's a shoehorn now after that fucking clang.
Level 2, Sarah's theme, which loosely translates from Japanese to English as Black Mooncat.
Black Mooncat coming right up.
Black Mooncat, man, to give a shout out to our favourite boy, Greenock.
You hear the kind of stabs on the MIDI keyboard there. That was the kind of cat screeching at the moon in the blackness of light, the blackness of the night. I think that's what they were going for there. Or it could have been a black cat that lives in the moon. We'll never know. We'll never know. But it's definitely the best tune.
All that subject to interpretation, isn't it?
It's all open to interpretation, man. And just like the plot of this game.
So, see what you're talking about the gameplay of this. Like, I mean, how does it compare to like some of your other 3D fighters, like Tekken or a Soul Calibur? I kind of get the impression it was maybe a bit more slow-paced.
Tekken is all about moving forward, isn't it? So, there's not much in the way of blocking, or there's no like really anticipation. You can sort of spam your way to a winning Tekken if you know what you're doing. All you need to do is time your punches. Timing works kind of differently in Virtua Fighter, in that you might only be able to execute a move for a couple of frames during another person's move. So whilst Cage has 40 odd moves, maybe only 16 of them can be executed at a certain point through someone else's move, if that makes any sense.
So a counter-attacking, it sounds like, is just as important as attacking.
A lot of counter-attack in this game. That's a big part of the game. And like, whilst in Tekken, you would just go to town. Like, you would just fight each other, go to town. And that's one. A lot of the round is spent kind of just sizing each other up and walking in a circle. Because if you get attacked once, the chances are he's going to get you on the ground and start kicking fuck at you. So you only really get attacked like two or three times and then that's it, the round's over. Kind of like Bushido in a way, man, because you're sounding each other out, you're displaying your moves and that, and like, before you go and like, make contact, I don't know. It's a very.
There's a bit of a mental game going on.
Tactical fighter.
I was just about to say, the way you're talking about it, it sounds an awful lot like Bushido Blade, man. That kind of fucking hesitance to get in at first.
Aye. You've got to size them up. You've got to get beat a couple of times. You've got to learn their moves, because you're not going to be able to execute Kuten Jisasagaraya. This is an actual move, by the way. Kuten Jisurakiyaku. Now, that's the worst fucking like way of saying that. That's a terrible translation, whatever it is, an interpretation. But basically, it's a move where if somebody moves into you towards your chest, you can get them in a headlock and perform this mad wrestling move on them. But you can only do it if they're like executing a move on you, and it only at a certain point. So you get like point fucking 1 second or something to execute it, and it's like forward, down, back, and then punch. It's quite it's,
can you pull stuff like that off?
Aye. Well, I've been playing this game for years, man. I know your Senpu Jerry's and your Ryaku Kiyaku's and but your Senpu Jerry's Higashi's as well. Right, I know them all. But, you know, it's I prefer it to Tekken, but for the sheer fact that in Tekken, I feel like I'm just in a panic, man, just trying to get around over with. In Virtua Fighter, you're using your brain, you're circling your opponent, and you're trying to work out his fighting style. And it takes a bit more tactics to win, because you know if he catches you, you're fucked.
This is a Thinking Man's fighting game, would you say?
Thinking Man's fighting game, aye. Just like the Thinking Man's Bob Marley, this is a Thinking Man's fighting game.
Right, I'm going to move us on. So, close us up. Give us some final thoughts about Virtua Fighter 2.
Virtua Fighter 2, man. Right, well, it's never been done since better. If you want to play a game that's total reality-based, a fighting game that's reality-based, that has no mad special powers, has no crazy injuries or fatalities or anything crazy like that, if you just want different fighting styles, facing off against each other, a nice retro feel and a cracking soundtrack, just play Virtua Fighter 2, I'm sure you won't be disappointed, because it still remains the best-selling arcade game and Saturn game in Japan.
So how do we play it? I guess you would have to have a Saturn, really.
Well, I think there's a PC version you could probably download for somewhere.
All right.
Saturn version isn't that expensive either, man. You can usually pick it up for about £7-8, but you need a Saturn first, that's probably hard. But it's not hard to get.
PC ports of that era were notoriously quite rubbish.
Aye,
across the port.
The music never worked properly, because I think the PC port was a port to Saturn, so they always did trouble fucking pairing up the soundtracks with PC ports, because the Saturn plays its soundtracks like a CD. But aye, Virtua Fighter 2, man, get it played. It's a big part of video game history. We wouldn't have texture mapping as we know it today if it wasn't for Virtua Fighter 2. So even just for that reason alone, you could play it. But if you want a good fighting game, if you're into Shenmue as well, this is the engine that started it all, get it played.
I'm interested in it for the Shenmue point of view, because it's a bit of a missing link in it, and how we got there.
I was trying my best not to mention it, the engine Shenmue, but this is the whole aesthetic of Shenmue is based on Virtua Fighter, and it shows, and that's a fucking brilliant thing. It's so Japanese, man. It's so cool. It's brilliant.
You get your gachapons on that in Shenmue, or Virtua Fighter characters.
Aye. And the good thing is, it's not been Americanized in any way. It retains all its Japanese-ness. It's class, man. It's good. It's good.
Right. So, June 2 was... It's called the Battle for Arrakis, in the Mega Drive version at least. It was arguably the first like real-time strategy game. There was an earlier game for the Mega Drive called Herzog's Vi, where you play as acclaimed documentary filmmaker Werner Herzog. he's in a helicopter, and you're kind of guiding soldiers around about the map, and a team called Westwood, based in, I think, California, they got a hold of this game and they quite liked it, and they wanted to take that to the next level, and they managed to get the license to the sci-fi series Dune, and made a kind of a real-time strategy based off of that. So Dune at the time was being adapted in the film, which we've talked about before, by David Lynch. So I think it was actually the rights holders from that kind of gave them the permission to make this game. You're effectively, it's got everything that a kind of a more modern strategy game has pretty much started in this. So you've got your kind of putting bases down, putting different buildings down at your base. Those buildings can create like troops, whether it's like soldiers or vehicles. You've also got a resource gathering element where you've got refineries and they're sending out things to get spice, which is the currency in this. You use that to buy units, and then you kind of send them across the map to attack the enemy base.
It sounds like a kind of grandfather or a father of like, say, your Age Empire doing things like that we had grown up with.
It's the granddaddy of real-time strategy games. Before this, all you had was like Civilization and turn-based strategy. And this was the first kind of one that ended up kind of setting the groundwork for Command and Conquer and stuff like that.
Aye, exactly. Well, it's actually the same team. It's quite amazing how much of it was there for like the very first installment. I mean, you've even got like the Fog of War, they call it, where like the map is blank before you send your troops out to explore it. The only thing that it doesn't have, which I think Command and Conquer maybe introduced, was dragging like a wee square around your units so you could select more than one at a time.
I always think of the Foggy Dew when somebody says Fog of War. Do you get Britannia's Huns with their long range guns riding in through the Foggy Dew in this?
Riding through the Fog of War. Nah. There's not a soundtrack of plaintive Irish rebel songs in the background. I don't know if the Sega's Yamaha sound chip can pull that. Unfortunately, it doesn't do a very good mandolin.
Man, but I'm fucking shite at them. I had this one called Ground Control as well, and I just couldn't play it, man. But you're good at it.
Ground Control to Major Tom.
Aye. I remember you used to play these games, man.
Aye, so like, I mean, there's been a few phases of like PC gaming. For one period, like the strategy games were your kind of the big blockbusters in the PC world. Like you had the Command and Conquer series, and then you had the spin-off Red Alert, Red Alert 2. Probably one of my favourites.
Oh, everybody had that, man. I remember that game well.
Aye,
there's that. You had like StarCraft and Warcraft. I mean, they're kind of very similar to that. Take a lot for Dune 2. So yeah, if you play those games, you'll be kind of right at home.
I play Black and White.
We used to play that fucking in the house. Black and White's quite a good wee game. That's Peter Molyneux, I think.
Peter Molyneux, aye. The one that done is it Daikatana and fucking...
No, Daikatana is, what's the slogan? He's about to make you his bitch.
Aye. it wasn't as good as Doom and all that, was it?
Black and White had a thing where it would whisper your own name at you when you were playing. Do you remember that?
It fucking did, aye. When one of your pops died, it was like, Michael,
Andy.
I just remember this one. There was these guys that tried to get wood for their boat, and they, for whatever reason, there was a drought or something, and they couldn't get any more wood, and they sang a mad song, man. I used to like that.
I don't remember. Again. I remember that. No, your man that made Daikatana was John Romero. This is Peter Molyneux, who was he was originally known for Populous, and he's known for Fable.
He
was also notorious for overpromising and underpromising.
Ah, that's the one.
There's one of his famous. There's these famous like rock star developers, weren't there, back in the day, between '90s and fucking 2000s. It was like the guy that made Doom and Quake and that. Was that John Romero?
Aye.
He became a pure superstar. I grew his hair long in that, remember?
Aye. Video games were rock and roll.
So what I'm wondering about Dune 2, obviously it ties into quite a lengthy, hardcore series of sci-fi fantasy novels. In the game, is there a lot of reading that way? Does it continue any of the stories, or do you have to really be at grips with the lore in order to get a full benefit of playing this?
I would say, as a setting, it's maybe not the best choice for a real-time strategy game. There is some kind of vehicles and sort of elements in the books are described in the books that it takes on, but the book isn't really that much about your big epic battles. It was kind of a fucking personal spiritual quest.
But they're said you're in resource wars. Is that right?
I'll try and summarise the plot of the book Dune.
Please do.
Right. So Dune is a very successful sci-fi novel, and I think its success derives a wee bit from it. Kind of resonated with people around about the 60s and 70s, with a lot of kind of themes that the counterculture were into.
New thought.
Aye, exactly. So it's got themes of, I guess, psychedelics, mind-altering drugs.
Is that not what a spice is? A spice makes you trip like fuck.
Aye, so it's kind of set in a far future, and there was a kind of big revolt against thinking machines called the Butlerian Jihad, and they use a lot of words from Islamic culture, which are maybe a bit dodgy nowadays, but it was called the Butlerian Jihad, and they outlawed thinking machines.
So thinking machines were haram, you're saying?
Thinking machines were absolutely haram. And to kind of get around this, to maintain this kind of feudal galactic empire, they make use of other technologies, and the main one being spice, which is only found on the planet Arrakis, where you're fighting over in this game. It's produced by these enormous creatures called sandworms. And spice, it kind of gives you mental clarity, but it also lets you have a kind of psychic abilities. It kind of enhances people's abilities to see into the future.
This is stuff so in Gateside Prison, spice.
It has a very similar effect, actually. So interstellar travel is accomplished by the Navigators Guild, and the Navigators are basically immersed in vaporized space, and that lets them see the sort of warp that navigate this warp, so they can travel from place to place. So it's the most valuable sort of resource in the galaxy. So at the start of the story, the main character is a guy called Paul Atreides, and his dad is head of the House Atreides. It's these kind of lordly families, dynasties.
Game of Thrones shit.
Aye.
So the Emperor has commissioned House Atreides to look after the planet Arrakis, which is a huge prestige, because the whole galaxy's economy runs off it. But it's actually a bit of a trap. As soon as they get there, they're attacked by the forces of their rival House Harkonnen. The Emperor thought that Atreides were getting too big for their boots, so they're basically decimated there. And Paul goes out into the desert, and he meets the kind of local people, the Fremen, who are kind of desert-going people, and he kind of learns their ways, and he also learns about his destiny. Secret of Destiny is like this kind of prophesied hero. He was actually, his mum is part of the secretive order, made by an order called the Bene Gesserit, and they've been trying for years to breed like a messiah, like a person who'll be able to see into the future and kind of guide civilization to the kind of shining path. So as I said, like, you know, you've got your kind of mind altering drugs and that kind of theme of like new thought, as well as the spice. There's characters called Mentats who are like basically human computers. So that's how kind of all the computation is done.
The name of the drug in Fallout, it increases your intelligence, isn't it? Mentats.
Aye, yeah, so that's where it comes from. And then you've got like, you know, soldiers who have kind of pushed themselves to the limits of like human ability, and that's kind of how who wages war. There's also the kind of environmental theme, like, you know, the kind of green movement was just starting around about that time as well. And it's about, a lot of it's about the kind of ecology of this planet and how like water is toxic to these sandworms, but the sandworms thrive and they produce this spice. So like if you're kind of fucking with the ecology of the planet, then that's all gone.
So in the video game, then, are you taking control of competing houses, trying to get control of Planet Arrakis?
Aye, exactly. So you've got House Atreides, kind of the noble good guys. House Harkonnen, scheming baddies. There's another one, which is House Ordos, and they're not in the books, but for whatever reason, they decided to fling in a third one. And all of these ones, they've got their own campaign. Campaigns are quite similar, but they've got like their own kind of units and stuff. So House Ordos are quite sneaky. Their first vehicle is like a kind of trike, like a kind of desert trike thing, which is a bit faster than Harkonnen and Atreides, who have quads, but they're also a bit more fragile. And they've got a kind of ultimate unit that like, can convert the enemy's unit over to your side.
Oh, I always like that in a strategy game, the kind of sneaky religious elements that come into some.
Yeah, Atreides have got some like kind of long-range weaponry, like tanks that can hit your base from quite far away. And Harkonnen, like, they've got a kind of super weapon, which is just like a really devastating missile called a Death Hand. When you're playing the game, you've got to be building a kind of balanced force. You know, all the units have got like their strengths and weaknesses. Some might be good for kind of scouting out the enemy base. Other ones are maybe slow moving, but are good against buildings and stuff like that. So that's a lot of the kind of the strategy of like when you're producing your force and that.
So tell me, what faction do you like playing as, and how do you tend to go for victory? How do you kind of focus that? Are you more scouting orientated? Do you just go for sheer force, or what do you kind of play it like?
I guess I'm always trying to focus on like the economy to start with, because you've got to make sure you've got these refineries sending the harvesters to get the spice. So I try and get as much of them as possible, which means I've always got plenty of money. And then from there, basically like overwhelm the enemy with sheer force, because I can build tanks faster than he can replace them. So that's a kind of one element. But it just depends who you're facing off against, what unit they've got, what might be the best approach. If there's a lot of infantry, then you might want to build some of the like the trikes or the quads that are kind of more fast moving and can run rings around them. And you've got to kind of, because you kind of select multiple units, you've got to kind of babysit your force, so you kind of have like a big massive army and just circle them all and say, right, you go over there. You've got to kind of control each one and like position them and make sure they're in the right place.
So is there quite a lot of micromanaging?
Aye, there is. The AI and stuff, isn't he super clever? So you can't always leave your forces unsupervised. Like, the enemy might send a party and it'll attack your base, and you've got soldiers on the other side of the base, and they won't do anything because, like, you need to, like, actually tell them you need to go around the corner and start fighting these enemies. So there's a bit of that. And, like, compounded by playing on the Mega Drive, you've not got a mouse. It can be a bit frustrating, but you've got to work around that.
So did you play the Mega Drive port then, or a PC one? I mean, updated one?
I had it on the PC when I was growing up, on my very first PC, but I played the Mega Drive version there just for convenience. But the Mega Drive port is pretty good. It's got, I think, pretty much everything that you had in the PC version. It's quite a good port. I think quite a light one, maybe like 1994 or something.
Andy Mac, are you still with us here?
I'm still with you. I'm just taking it all in. I've never No, that's the question. You did. I noticed there was a Mega Drive version. I'm interested in like the differences between the Mega Drive version and the DOS version. I mean, is there any key differences, or have you only played the DOS version?
It's very similar. Like, if you're familiar with PC games around about that time, they had like the Sound Blaster chip, and that had quite a distinctive sound. I thought the Mega Drive would maybe sound a bit different, but that it kind of sounds like a PC game almost, if you kind of know what you're listening out for. The only thing that I don't think is maybe in the Mega Drive one that you got on the PC that I could notice is when you're playing the campaign on the PC, sometimes you got a choice. Like if you're Ardos, it's like, okay, next mission, you can attack the Atreides in this square of the world map, or the Harkonnen in this one of the world map, which ones you want to choose. I didn't get hit with that in the Mega Drive port, but I don't really know why. I don't know why that was a feature that didn't make it in.
But if you look at DOS games and Mega Drive games, there's usually quite a lot of stuff missing. So, I mean, even any attempt to try and retain as much as they can in Dune 2, which I've never played. And I was trying to keep up with you. See, when you were trying to explain the story, I was at least I kept it nice and simple.
I mean, it's a lot to cram in. And like,
I've gotten up, yeah, my favourite's Theme Hospital.
Aye, Theme, well, that's its kind of own thing. You're not sending your doctors out to destroy another hospital.
You fucking should be. That would be a good game.
The reason it's called Dune 2, which is a bit strange, there was another game called Dune, and they were both developed in parallel by like two different teams, and they're totally unrelated to each other. Dune 1 was made by, I think they're called Cryo, a French company, and that was a lot more like an RPG, which sounds maybe like more suited to the plot of the game, the plot of the book, sorry.
Aye.
But I think basically that game, Dune 2 was late, and that came out, and then Westwood are like, fuck, we can't call another game Dune. It comes out like 6 months after the first one. So, yeah, they just went with the name Dune 2. But like,
Dune kind of copied the Phantom Boss, or the Phantom Menace copied Dune a wee bit.
In what way?
Look, the complexity to the storyline and shit, man, for science fiction film.
With the Trade Federation in that? Oh.
Like the politics and the Phantom Menace. This might be a brain fart, but...
I was waiting for a hot take, and then I think you might have farted.
No, I mean, you're potentially onto something, right? Because, I mean, Star Wars, the original trilogy, didn't have any politics or anything. Dune is maybe more along those lines. In the book, like, a lot of the action is basically like these big conversations and fucking philosophical treaties and stuff like that. It's probably why it was so difficult to adapt into a film. There's been like the one effort by a guy called Jodorowsky, who his one was never made. David Lynch one is not really considered a success, and then they're having another bash at it now.
See that, man?
I mean, it's a lot more complex and less straightforward a story than something like Star Wars.
I've seen the Lynch one, I think, that's all. So.
Yeah.
I watched that film, man, and I couldn't get it. I think that possibly you've got to be familiar with the whole world, didn't you, before you watch a Lynch film? I don't know.
Aye, because there's so much to put it to fit in, and they probably had to like skim over a lot of the lore and stuff like that.
I'm a bit of a Lynch-head like yourself, Andy, and it wasn't one of my scene.
Nah, definitely. Vanilla Sky, that's another good one, but it was nae Mulholland Drive.
Blue Velvet for me, got to be up there.
Velvet's good day. Also, obviously, some episodes of Twin Peaks are right up there, man.
Oh, yeah. I would play a real-time strategy game based on Twin Peaks where you had to move the bookhouse boys about and try and fight the forces of darkness.
That one MPR fucking games, man, the Bob creeps up on you. Sorry, Mitch.
Oh, no worries. There's an aesthetic to this game, which are pure light, and like that kind of, obviously it comes with a written word, so that's not taken for any sort of published material, but I just think it's got a whole kind of look at it that's pretty unique. There's these soldiers that you're kind of soldiers, and they're wearing these big kind of like masks to cover them, their faces in the desert and stuff like that. And The units are quite kind of chunky looking, so that always kind of appealed to me and stuck with me as a child.
So the presentation of the different factions, they're all quite kind of, I don't know, high fantasy looking, colourful. It's not, they're not that gritty, are they?
You get a kind of a wee screen, like depending on which house you choose. There's like a wee introduction to each mission where you're getting spoken to by that house's mentor, and they're like, they've got these kind of nice big expressive faces, and they're talking to you and telling you what your next mission is and stuff like that. That's the kind of uniqueness of this world. Like it is almost like a fantasy, because I mean, what other sci-fi books do you have that don't have computers in them?
Yeah, exactly. Fucking sandworms and shit.
Yeah, and I think that was maybe one of the things that attracted Lynch to the series, was the kind of campiness and the big ridiculous costumes and the kind of like it's all
counterculture themes.
It's definitely kind of unique, and you can see why folk have had a lot of traction trying to adapt it into video games and stuff. I think the world sort of lends itself quite nicely to that.
Give us a wee bit of your experience playing it before we move on. What was your gameplay experience when you stuck this on last night?
I was flicking about, basically just trying to get a wee feel for the different factions and stuff like that. Because, you know, as I said, they've got their own units and their own playstyle. So yeah, it was good. It was quite challenging. After level two or three or so, you're getting constantly sort of harassed by the enemy, so you've got to get your economy up and running pretty quickly before they start, you know, parking their tanks in front of your base.
That sounds potentially stressful to me, man. Like, you could be getting overwhelmed if you're not fucking on point.
And that's something I've never been all that great with strategy games, but I was kind of starting to get the hang of it. Yeah, as I say, you kind of start noticing a few things. One thing that I kind of got the impression of, and then I read it, actually the wiki confirmed it, was like the AI in this game, it doesn't have any concept of like flanking, so it's not going to try and get around to the back of your base or try and like figure out your holes in your defence or that. It basically is just going to send its troop from their base in a straight line to your base.
Well, I mean, that tracks if it's one of the first ones, you know, it can't be that sophisticated.
And apparently, actually, they had, coded the ability for them to do that, but for whatever reason, there was a bug. There was a bug and it didn't happen. Although what you do get in later levels is there's a way you can hire mercenaries, and the mercenaries are pretty much like parachuted in to the enemy base. So you do sometimes get the mercenaries fucking turn up in places where you don't expect them. I was quite enjoying it. I was enjoying the challenge, and like it was just, you know, I kind of expected to be disappointed because it's so early that I thought it'd be quite rudimentary. But I think it holds up, and it's a kind of maybe a good introduction to these sort of strategy games.
Oh, right. Like we sometimes say in the podcast, is it maybe a baby's first?
I wouldn't go as far as that, because I mean it's still difficult, but. Yeah, if you don't know what you're doing when they're complex strategy games, then there's kind of a wee bit less to concern yourself with. There's not as many units and stuff.
Is it a wee bit like other franchises or even genres where the first game sort of lays the groundwork and it doesn't peak until what, a few games later? Look, this is Westwood game, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's not quite as accomplished as your Red Alert 2 or something like that.
June 2 is essentially there might not be a Command and Conquer, you know, that's one way to look at it.
Aye, definitely. So from a historical perspective, it's quite good, but it's also it does hold up. I like the way that in the campaign it unlocks more things as you go through the missions, and that's another kind of feature of games like Command and Conquer and stuff like that. Like, you in the first mission, it's all just about getting the harvesters and getting your getting spice back to the base and stuff, and then it introduces like you can build ground troops, and then later on you can kind of upgrade your buildings and build new types of troops until the end you've got all your defences and wars, and you've got your super weapons and your kind of super tanks and all that. So it kind of ramps up in complexity in a good way. It kind of teaches you how to play the play everything at a good pace.
I did. They should introduce these things gradually. It sounds like that was a problem with Lemons too.
Yeah, I know. We should just fucking flinch into the deep end and put it. Figure out how to use 8 different new types of lemmings synergistically.
Aye.
But aye, it's a recommendation for me, as are, I would say, maybe the first 3 or 4 books by Frank Herbert. The one that I gave up on was a sequel where one of Paul Atreides' kids has fused himself with the giant sandworms and became a god emperor. And he is kind of trying to plan out the future of humanity to avoid a great evil. And it's all told from the perspective of this giant half-worm, half-human that has prophetic dreams. And it's really strange and off-putting.
Still sounds pretty good. I've always been a bit daunted by getting into the books. No, as if it's a real kind of undertaking.
Because there's a lot of them. And as I mentioned before, he's not the best writer in the world, but he does have some cool concepts. And after he died, there was a couple of prequel series, and then later a sequel by his son, which are kind of universally reviled. Oh. people really don't like them. When you hear about in the first book, The Butlerian Jihad, it's kind of told as if it's an awakening of consciousness sort of thing, against, our whole lives have been controlled by machines and stuff like that.
Aye.
And then when you go back to the books that he's written about the event, it's Terminator.
Oh.
Yeah, actually, in that sense. It's a recommendation for me. If you want to, dip your toe in the water or time strategies, then probably no better choice in the OG.
Well, I might stick it on over the next couple of days and fuck about with it.
See what it's all about. Strategy games, I don't know, man, but it's good to hear a wee overview of the granddaddy of them all, man.
And you liked about Age of Empires, though, didn't you?
Age of Empires 2 was class. That was good. I don't know what it was about that game, but it had a nice flow to it. And it was a better played as a multiplayer game, that game.
I don't know if Dune 2 actually had multiplayer, but I mean, that's a staple of the genre going forward.
The good thing about Age of Empires 2 was there was that 15 minutes at the start where you set everything up and you knew it was going down in a minute, you know?
Aye.
I know, I almost just want that before the enemy fucking gets on your doorstep.
That was class, man. And then
quick hit.
And then you start to see the soldiers marching your way, man. You tell, oh fuck, I'm not done yet. And aye, good times.
I just played the Robert the Bruce campaign over and over again. I don't know if it was just because I was patriotic. Right, well, will I go on to Maniac Mansion then?
Aye.
Go for it.
Right, the reason I picked this one is because it was something I've got a long history with. I remember talking about it on the playground in St. Mary's, where I can't remember who, but they were sort of talking to us about Dr. Fred and did you get this item and have you been past the green tentacle and things like this. My first exposure to it was actually, used both are probably aware of this, but in the game Day of the Tentacle, which was a sequel to Maniac Mansion, it came fully stocked with a port of Maniac Mansion.
Through a telly or something like that?
You clicked on the computer in Weird Ed's room, and then you just got to play the full Maniac Mansion game. I don't even know if they advertised that or if they just kind of snuck it in.
It was just an Easter egg.
Pretty cool.
But, so it's a point-and-click adventure game designed by the great Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick. And I think it was your sort of introduction to this Scum engine, or one of the first. So, you click a bit on screen, you move your character around, and underneath them you have this just kind of word bank with loads of different verbs. Pick up, turn on, turn off, use, get, open, close, etc. Games nowadays, they just tend to have the kind of one intuitive button that you interact with everything with, and it will just do the thing rather than making you. Because obviously it was a jump on for text adventures.
Aye, normally we'd have typed that.
Aye. Some people don't like the kind of word bank thing, open, close, blah, blah, blah. But because I grew up with it and no text adventures, I find text adventures to be the ones that are more confusing. I don't always know the language of the game, if that makes sense.
I think Simon the Sorcerer, was that not one of the first ones that came out that was like, do this, do that, but it wasn't a text?
No, Simon the Sorcerer was kind of a British team trying to do their take on these games. Sorry. It was kind of, I guess, like Britain's answer to Monkey Island or something.
So, speaking of Monkey Island, this is also LucasArts, or at the time they were called Lucasfilm Games, but very much the precursor to LucasArts and all those fucking wonderful adventure games, your Monkey Islands, Day of the Tentacle, obviously, I know we all love. So, aye, this, you can think of this as a granddaddy as well. So the plot of it very much thrives for your kind of 80s B-horror movies. It's got a really kind of atmospheric intro where you see a meteor crash into the Earth. It says 20 years ago today, the meteor hits, starts playing that fucking opening tune. You see all the lights on the mansion go up and then fucking opening title sequence. So basically, you're a guy called Dave, whose girlfriend Sandy has been kidnapped by the evil Dr. Fred, who is being mind-controlled by an evil meteor, and the meteor wants to suck her brains out for some unexplained reason, because it's a fucking prick, I suppose. And along with Dave, you have to make up a squad. I know we all like a squad, and you get sort of 5 other teenagers to pick from, and they all have different sort of powers. I'll give you the... Do you want the blobs for your different teenagers?
Go for it.
Right, so you've got Razor. She's the leader of a punk band called Razor and the Scumettes. She's pretty cool, and Scum's obviously a nice wee nod to the kind of Scum engine that it runs on. You've got Bernard, it says, is the Geek Award winner and Physics Club president.
Protagonist of The Identical.
That's right. Bernard goes on to become a main character in your sort of pseudo-sequel, along with his pals Hoagie and Laverne, who unfortunately aren't in this. And you've got Sid, he's another musician-type character. He's an aspiring musician who hopes to start his own band. He's into kind of new wave type stuff. I'm not that keen on him. You've got Wendy. She's kind of like preppy looking, but she's waiting for her first big break as a novelist. So when I play, I like using Wendy because Wendy's a writer and I'm a writer too. You've got a character who you pretty much shouldn't take along because he doesn't have any special powers. He's called Jeff. He lives on the beach and answers to Surfer Dude. He's a kind of surfer. And the only black character in the game, Michael, ace photographer for the college newspaper. And if you could throw us in a little bit of Michael's theme, because it's just so fucking funky. Was Michael's theme from Lucasfilm Games. basically your standard fare. You go in with your squad of your three teens. You solve a variety of esoteric puzzles, try to make your way through this mansion, and ultimately save Sandy for getting her brain sucked out by Dr. Fred.
I like your choice of words there. Esoteric puzzles. That kind of leaves a lot to be discussed there.
Well, I mean, that's kind of sums up like some of the puzzles in these games. Some of the solutions were so obscure. Like, how does this rate as like comparison to like you know, Monkey Island and stuff like that? What ratio of the puzzles do you like? Oh, for fuck's sake, that is ridiculous. Like, I'd never have thought of that.
This is worse because by the time a Monkey Island won, they had got to kind of. So you've got LucasArts and Sierra, right? If we want to compare the two, Sierra games had hundreds of points where you could just lock yourself into a fail state. See, if you didn't pick up a certain item at a certain time, couldn't get back to it, couldn't beat a game.
You'd also die at certain points for like bullshit reasons.
So Maniac Mansion, the characters can die, and also you can have fail states where if you do something wrong, you can lock yourself for completing the game. By the time Monkey Island came along...
Would they my fucking head in, man, honestly.
It's no good, man. It's why by the time Monkey Island, they decided, well, do you know what? Nobody actually likes that. Our philosophy should be that it's fun. Do you know what I mean? Monkey Island, you can never ruin a game for yourself and make it so that you can never fucking win.
I have to say, can I should be, man. What about pixel hunting? That's a usual criticism of games like this. Partly LucasArts used to have this mechanic where you would have to literally search every pixel on the screen before you could progress.
Maniac Mansion has a bit of that. Notably for me, some rooms you'll go into in the mansion and they'll be dark, and then you just have to move your cursor about until you see light, and then go turn on light, and then the room will be light again. That's kind of pixel hunting. In terms of bad offenders for a puzzle, for me, the one I've noted doing, I think I was telling you on the chat. So when you're playing as Wendy, and I believe if you're playing as Razor or Sid, and you want to kind of beat the game their way, there are multiple ways to beat the game, by the way. I'll go into that in a bit. With Wendy, it involves taking a manuscript for a memoir that the Meteor has written, using it in a typewriter to fix it, because it's kind of shit, and Meteor can't really write. But he's got quite an interesting story. And finding an envelope, putting the manuscript in the envelope, putting stamps on the envelope, and posting it to this publisher so that you can get $1 million recording contract, $1 million publishing contract, rather, for the Meteor, and that kind of convinces him not to be evil. But in order to get the envelope, you need to look through a telescope to get a code for a safe that's in Nurse Edna's bedroom. Then you need to find a handle for a water faucet to turn it, to spray some water on a mummy so that it moves out of the way, and you can get Nurse Edna's phone number, because in the toilet it says, for a good time, call Edna, because Nurse Edna's a bit of an old dirty. So you phone her, get her safe in her room, then you open up the safe with the code that you've got for fucking turning on a giant telescope, and then you get an envelope. If you open the envelope, you tear it, and you kind of complete the game that way anymore. You've just fucked yourself. There's no other envelope, it's done. It's fucked. So you have to put the envelope in a microwave, weigh a jar of water, and then close the microwave door, turn the microwave on. That steams the envelope open, and then you can use the envelope to put the manuscript in.
That fucking classic way of getting boiling water, putting a cup of water in a microwave.
Oh, it's fucked.
What process is that, man? Because that's not even feasible in real life. So what the fuck are you meant to work that out? That's a bit fucked up.
Okay, there are certain things in this where you've either had to have bought the strategy guide, phoned one of the fucking tip lines that were a pure price gouge, or just tried absolutely fucking every conceivable thing under the sun.
Was this game ported to the NES?
So I played it on the NES this time round. I remember a couple of years ago now, Aero was working in a charity shop. Do you know how with Brew were doing that thing where if you'd signed on for an amount of time, they just made you go and do some shite for basically nothing? So he was doing that, and somebody swapped in an old NES, donated it or whatever. So he bought it, and then the two of us followed some YouTube tutorials, fucking fixed this thing up, and it was playing games, and you were just thinking, fucking amazing.
Cool.
And we were just trying to look at what games we could get on the cheap. I got a copy of Maniac Mansion for about a fiver, and then obviously, because I knew it for playing Day of the Tentacle when I was younger and that, and I was like, fucking brilliant. The NES version's quite a good port. The graphics don't look too bad. There are nicer looking ports. But for me, the tunes, I think, on the Nintendo version are maybe better than certainly the C64 and a couple of other versions where they sound maybe a wee bit dodgier.
It's censored, but there's an awesome swearing in Maniac Mansion that I'm guessing didn't make it into the Nintendo port. Because we all know the only game with swearing is Hong Kong 97.
Well,
I did not know that.
There are some strange instances of censorship. Like, there's a room in the mansion. By the way, the mansion is very, very well mapped out. The design of the mansion is great. You can kind of learn where everything is pretty quickly. And this is owed to the fact that Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick and another guy, I think his name was David Fox or something like that, they had designed this originally as a board game. So they had this big Stoughton mansion already mapped out, and they'd playtested the board game version a load of times. So when they converted it to a video game, you know, the layout of the mansion just works really well.
That's one thing I really don't like in some adventure games, where you've got a puzzle that requires you to go from like one end of a fucking cave system to another, and you don't know which door lead you where. There was a wee bit of that in Fate of Atlantis. I'm glad the mansion's kind of like quite well laid out in that sense.
So, owing to the fact that there actually is quite a bit of backtracking, kind of going back and forth for rooms, sometimes having to switch items between your three kids, depending on who's doing what puzzle. But as I say, the mercy of that is the mansion's fucking great. The design of the mansion is fucking fantastic.
Is it like, as funny as the later ones, like, you kind of, your Day of the Tentacles and Monk Gales and stuff? Because, like, those games at the time were kind of known for their humour.
Yeah, it is very funny. I was talking about censorship. So there's a room in the mansion where there's a sarcophagus, and in most of your PC things, there's like a pin-up on the wall of a sexy lady, but obviously it's like, as a mummy version. It's like a wrapped-up corpse, but it's lying kind of sexily. The NES version takes stuff like that out. At the start, Dave kind of gives your two other teenagers a pep talk. Says, if anybody wants to go, now's your chance. And if Bernard's there, because Bernard's a kind of wee geek, he goes like that, right? Sees later. And then Dave, in the Nintendo version, says, Bernard, don't be a tuna head. This is Sandy we're talking about. But in some of your edgier versions, he says, Bernard, don't be a shithead.
Aye.
a tuna head?
Tuna head. Tuna head is an inserted fucking slur in this for some reason. There's a couple of instances where characters call each other tuna head.
I don't know. I'm not getting tuna head. They could have come up with something better, but I suppose
no.
Probably this is an American game, isn't it? So probably a Japanese translation. I just call it tuna head instead.
Maybe. The other classic instance of censorship, because I would be remiss talking about Maniac Mansion if I didn't mention it, is blowing up a hamster in a microwave.
Aye.
So if he's remembering Day of the Tentacle, Weird Ed has his hamster, sits in the cage reading the Wall Street Journal. There's a puzzle in that game where you have to freeze a hamster, send it through time in order to power a generator in the future. The hamster's still there, alive and well in Maniac Mansion. However, you can put it in the microwave and turn the microwave on and it will explode the hamster. Which I think in Day of the Tentacle, they were kind of doing an ironic like wink to, because there's a puzzle where you actually have to microwave the hamster.
Aye, it's like unfreeze it.
Yeah, it's in a blog.
Joe cartoon.
Aye, I remember that. That was one of the fucking, one of the Flash animations that fucked us up as children.
I don't know if they were like, fans of fucking Maniac Mansion and Tentacle, because... that's a pretty original thought, isn't it? Like a hamster in the microwave, so maybe they've got some connection. But anyway,
or maybe they're just a psychopath.
so interestingly enough, the first run of NES cartridges in this still had the fucking exploding hamster in them. That managed to get snuck past the sensors, and then I think there was some moral outrage about it, and it got patched out from that point on. I think your character says something like, no, I could never do something like that. But, well, you can, because you've done it in other versions of this game. other links to Day of the Tentacle, you've got the green tentacle and the purple tentacle. They're both in this.
They're in it, man. It's good part of the second one. I think it's green tentacle, I like. He's got a part.
Green.
He's daft as
green
fuck.
Green tentacle in this one, you'd still like him. He's still a kind of wee melancholic dude. He's upset because he thinks his band will never succeed. So if you're playing as one of the musician kids, you can play music for him, and then he says, "Mon, join my band," and then get his demo tape fucking published, and then he'll help you get into Purple Tentacle's room and fucking free Sandy for Dr. Fred.
I always said that fucking Green Tentacle and Hoagie, face second man, should meet up, man, because they'd be good pals.
Aye. Well, maybe. I mean, that's why Green Tentacle and Bernard have a pre-standing friendship when you start Day of the Tentacle. You get a letter for Green Tentacle, it kicks the whole thing out. Part of the reason I picked Maniac Mansion was it is supposed to be a funnier game, mostly owing to the fact that you've got these kind of wacky characters and wacky situations, you know, like a disembodied tentacle that wants to start his own band and that. It's pretty amusing. But for me, I found the game really, really scary, down to a very simple subversion of a key part of video games. So you play a lot of video games as a kid. You learn that the world in these games doesn't work like a real world. If you walk into somebody's house in a video game, they just talk to you. They might offer you a hint or offer you an item or something like that. Whereas in Maniac Mansion, somebody catches you in their house, the mansion, they fucking go mental. They start shouting, "What are you doing in my house? What are you doing in my house?" Chase you about the room, fucking lock you in a dungeon. So when I was a wee guy, it really captured the essence of I'm in somebody's house and I'm not meant to be in somebody's house. It felt weirdly intimate. No, I was sneaking about and looking into other rooms and that.
Trying to put their drawers and things like that.
Yeah, and there are these pre-scripted events where, like, we're dead, we'll go down and make you sell a piece. So if any of your characters are standing in the corridors or in the kitchen while he's going, he'll catch you. I don't know if it was just because I was young, but I tended to think that you were never safe, that these characters just kind of mulled about the house and could catch you at any point. Obviously, it's not the case, but at least when I was a kid, it had a really good way of making you feel like that was the case.
And that's what you get with Gregory Horror Show. Like, you're trying not to be in the same place as people that are to hurt you.
Maybe that's why I like it so much as well. Yeah. But there's a thematic link there that I hadn't considered.
See when you talk about like the structure of the game, like the fact that there's multiple endings.
Aye.
Is there stuff that you have to do in every playthrough, or is it just like a completely different path to finishing it?
There's a skeleton that's the same. So in order to access the upper floor of the mansion and get a bunch of extra rooms that you can do extra puzzles in, when you first come in, Green Tentacle stands in a hallway and he doesn't let you past until you give him his favourite food and then a drink to wash it down with. Green Tentacle, so you can get a load of stuff out the fridge. You can find manky leftover Sunday dinner, like a rotten turkey and that. You can give him all that, and when you do that, he just keeps saying, "Mare, please, mare, please." What you need to do is go into the art room where somebody's been painting, get a bowl of wax fruit, and that's Green Tentacle's favourite food.
okay, now.
And then you give him some fruit juice, and he considers you a pal. He lets you through, and you can go into his room and that. There's a series of keys and stuff like that you need to get in the same order as well, depending on what character you're.
I think, like, Purple Tentacle is a bit of a wanker, man. Like, do you think he kind of fucking has something on Green Tentacle that can get him in jail or something? Because he's always just kind of bitching him about it, isn't he? He's like,
I think Green Tentacles just get quite low self-esteem.
The thing about Purple Tentacle is that he's a bit of an idiot. That's why in Day of the Tentacle, when he drinks that sludge, gets the wee arms, it gives him super intelligence, because otherwise he's pretty thick, whereas Green Tentacle's more kind of sensitive. But this is a great old kind of, if you like a point and click genre, this is a great fucking atmospheric introduction to it. Or, you know, if you're an aficionado and you want to play something older, you probably will have to go to a walkthrough at some point, but you can play a lot of the game without one. Maybe just when you're getting to the more kind of puzzles that get you towards a solution overall, there's certain things that you need to do that just don't make a lot of sense.
It's probably the LucasArts one I've played the least of. I didn't play a whole lot of Loom, but I don't know why I've never really went back to Maniac Mansion. I want to check it out.
If you play through as Bernard, there's this whole thing where you use tools on this kind of space phone, and you phone a space police and fucking grass up a meteor, and then they come and get them. The end and add-on, as I say, the writer lassie, you find the meteor's memoirs, you punch them up, fucking rewrite them, make them a bit better. Then when you get them a recording contract, the ending is just you and the meteor on a talk show, and he talks about how he's given up his evil ways in order to become a writer. and then he calls you onto the stage and that. It's quite good.
They must be fucking high as fuck when they're writing the narrative for these games, man, but that's never a bad thing, especially in terms of point-and-click adventures where Houston gets so hard. You've always got a bit of comic relief coming up after it, and it makes it kind of worth it, doesn't it? That's what I got for Tentacle anyway, second one.
Oh, aye. If you like Day of the Tentacle, you like Maniac Man.
Aye. There's a real charm to your games.
Aye.
I think there's a bit of a stoned logic to the puzzles as well, something.
Oh, there's a puzzle in Day of the Tentacle that when you're playing it as an eight-year-old, you don't get it because it's a dad joke. When you're doing Hoagie's bit, there's a bit where you need to bring a storm on. So you start washing a cart, and then that makes a thunderstorm come. Because obviously, oh no, just washing my car, then obviously it rains, haha. It's a fucking dad joke. A 10-year-old's not going to think of that.
The one that sticks out to me is in Monkey Island, where there's like a really tight screw, and you use the monkey weight, and it opens up, and it's like a monkey wrench.
Again, another dad joke. by the way, Monkey Island-wise, I've been thinking about it in Curse of Monkey Island, my favourite one, the third one. I know that's fucking unorthodox, probably sacrilege, because everybody knows two is the Empire Strikes Back, a Monkey Island. But I like the third one best.
Third one's got some pretty good things going for it as well.
So what made Julian Banjo's?
That's the third one, aye. It's a cartoony presentation. Everything looks fucking like a hand-drawn cartoon. It's fucking magic, man.
Aye, quite.
And you like a wisecracking skull as well.
Aye, Murray the Skull. Shout out to Murray the Skull.
Have you ever played Grim Fandango?
Aye, Grim Fandango is a top 10 game for me, probably. Maybe even top 5. Out of all these kind of adventure games, Grim Fandango is my favourite.
It's your game, man. It's fucking funny.
I would have maybe have done that, but I couldn't complete it in a night. Whereas Maniac Mansion, I remembered 90% of, and then had to fucking walk through a couple of other wee bits there.
You can't really go wrong with LucasArts adventure games. Pretty much all of them are pretty great. Sam and Max are fucking Full Throttle, both crackers as well.
I think in terms of recommendations, play any of them at the minute. See, fucking you're stuck inside, you're looking for things to play. Fucking these old school adventure games keep you laughing, fucking keep you thinking. Their presentation's all really fucking charming and great as well. Get involved, man. Your Sam and Max, your Monkey Island, Maniac Mansion, Dare the Tentacle, fucking anything.
Also, the music is also pretty good, man. It's the wee quips and stuff, like the wee audibles that they play. I read about, funny enough, the Lion King's development. And, somebody that worked for the company that done that used to work for LucasArts, and they said that they got, when they were writing the tunes for it, they integrated something into the code that made it so that the tunes played and cue was happening on the screen. And that was quite a new thing at the time.
Aye, Monkey Island was famous for that. It would kind of fade in and out elements of the tune based on where you were. So, like, if you're walking about the towards the pub, it might add a wee... might not be the right thing, but you know, a wee bit of accordion or something might fade in, and then you walk to the other side of the map and like the tune will kind of morph into something else.
Aye, when you're playing the first island in Monkey Island 2, man, that fucking blew my mind.
Aye. But a lot of games do that in kind of quite sophisticated ways now, but that Monkey Island kicked it off.
Aye. So that's it for me. It was just a nice wee memory to dip back into. And I recommend fucking point-and-click adventure games over the next while if you're looking for things to play.
Aye, definitely. And we'll probably cover, in the next few weeks, maybe a slightly meatier RPG or something that you can fucking sink your teeth into.
Aye, I mean, as I say, we might even consider recording more than one of these a week, depending on how this one sounds and how bored we get. We might have plenty more for you.
My prediction for you is that each episode are going to get more and more tenuous as the weeks go on.
Aye, it's going to be a case of day 10. Fuck,
it'll be like
fever.
he'll be like fucking audio logs for Resident Evil. oh, they don't get audio logs. What am I talking about?
Bioshock.
Aye. Right, let's do the swap.
Okay, they bother. Will I go first?
Yeah.
Mick.
You know what you're getting me?
McCormick, I've got a very special game to give you.
Right.
It's a very game that's very close to my heart. It's got obviously a very nice soundtrack. And it features.
Please don't play
Radio
that.
Poison.
So one of the most amazing aquatic mammals in the world ever made. I would stop the bullshit. You're getting an echoey dolphin.
All right, perfect.
So right, Quest 64's been fucking punted. Right, Mick, what you got for me?
Fucking hell. I wasn't ready for this. He's like 5 seconds.
Oh, I can't wait to see what he pulls out his arse.
No, you know what? I'll go my original plan. You can play Mega Man Zero. So yeah, fan of Mega Man, fan of Mega Man X. This was its kind of hard as nails, slightly updated series on the Game Boy Advance.
I'll get a bash. Andy, I'm going to give you something that I think you probably have played. I reckon you've never completed it. I don't think, as far as I'm aware. Quackshot on the old Sega Mega Drive.
Aye, man. I've been joking for you to play that again anyway, so I'll stick that on the mini and get a bash, man. Cool.
Aye. I complete it about once a year, I think.
It's an old classic, man.
Aye, definitely. Right, well, thanks for joining us again, listeners. We'll see how this one turns out.
Everybody, stay indoors. Don't go, follow the advice of the government for a change.
Also, we shagged the government.
Aye, pump Boris.